Today, why are hundreds of seafarers being abandoned on ships at sea without wages or supplies? And The Guardian's wealth correspondent on the growing influx of the global super rich to Italy.
She's standing in her living room in her bare feet. She's got a little blue skirt on with pink flower on it. She's got her hands thrust in her pockets, a television and a kind of music player in the background. She looks as though she's about to dance. Captain Ipan sent me this picture of his daughter, but he hasn't seen her in 2 years.
Captain Ipan is trapped on a rusting boat anchored around 5 miles off the coast of the United Arab Emirates.
Papa, good morning, Papa.
He can only communicate with his family through voice messages sent by WhatsApp using snatched Wi-Fi from passing ships. That's Aniha, telling her father that she talks to and kisses his photo every day that he's away.
He left when she was 4 years old and she's now 6 years old, and he has not set foot on land in all that time.
The Guardian's global development correspondent Karen McVeigh has been using the same method to receive messages from Captain Ipan.
Good evening, madam. I'm really sorry. We are in anchorage now. We are far away from shore, nearly for more than 5 miles. So we didn't get a proper signal.
He is one of hundreds of seafarers stranded on ships without supplies, wages or fuel as a result of disputes with employers who are being accused of modern-day slavery. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, abandoned at sea.
Can you tell me about the last time you saw your family, your wife Manaka, and your little daughter?
I left my family on January 2017.
He left in January 2017. He left his village of Kumkazonam in southern India, and he told her, "Don't worry, I'll see you soon. Mum and Grandma are here, they'll look after you."
Tell me where Captain Ipan was going that day.
On that day, when he left home, he was flying to the Gulf to start work on a cargo ship which was operating between the UAE and Iraq.
Cargo is rock stones.
Delivering building materials between various ports.
Iraq.
And he was going to work on a ship called the Asrock Maya, which was UAE flagged and owned by a UAE company called Elite Way Marine Services. He'd signed up for 8 months.
So his job is essentially to be a seafarer?
Yes, merchant seaman. He was actually trained in the UK at a nautical college in Blackpool. He's been a captain for 21 years. He's a very experienced seafarer.
Captain Ipan set off to work in the Persian Gulf with his 10-man crew, some of them just 19 years old on their first big job. For 8 months, everything went to plan. They carried out the work and received their salaries. But as the contract was coming to an end, there was a technical issue with the main engine that meant taking the ship to port for servicing. Captain Ipan says this is what happened next. As time dragged on, he began to ask for a replacement captain and the rest of his salary so he could leave the ship. But after 4 months, the owner told him the company had run out of money. He was told to take the ship, which is huge but only has a small area for the crew to live in, a few miles off the coast, and drop the anchor. The situation, they said, would be sorted out soon.
When did you first realised that Elite Way Marine Services were in financial trouble?
After we drop anchor in Hamriya, we asked the salary to the company, what about our dues? Then they paid 1 month salary. And they promised us, go drop anchor, within 15 days you will get a charter. You're going to be loading to Fujairah.
Captain Ayapan had been told that once the company secured another contract, they would be paid. But after those 15 days, they found out the contract had fallen through, and they were plunged into a dispute over their missing wages in the year since.
He got promises from the owner to say, oh yeah, things will happen soon. And then eventually they began running out of supplies.
Yes, madam. Slowly, company stopped our supply.
They didn't get fuel. Fuel was very low. They didn't get food and water. And they began realising over a period of months, really,
we are going to be in some
that
trouble.
They were in trouble. They're getting less contact with the owner and their wages are not being paid. Their families are wondering what's happening. All of the seafarers have families at home. They're reliant on them. They're mostly the main breadwinner for their entire family. They're stranded 6 nautical miles off the coast.
April 1st, I informed to all authorities.
So in April 2018, Captain Ayapan goes to the authorities and he discovers that there are 7 or 8 other ships in similar situations. They're essentially floating prisons with seafarers on board who have come from thousands of miles away in southern India. Do we know how common stories like this are?
Unions refer to these workers as invisible. The International Transport Workers Federation have reported many cases like this. The International Maritime Organization and the Labour Organization have a joint database showing 4,000 seafarers have been abandoned since 2004.
4,000?
4,000 since 2004, yes. And in recent years, the numbers have increased.
Abandonment at sea is a key issue for the charity The Mission to Seafarers, as Reverend Andy Bowerman discovered after starting a new role as the regional director for the Gulf and South Asia in late 2018.
So I arrived into the UAE at the beginning of October, and I had a message in the office probably on my second or third day. It was fairly scratchy. It was a WhatsApp voice message. He sent 2 or 3 separate ones. And as far as I could make out, he was saying that there were up to 40 seafarers on 7 vessels. I checked that out with the rest of the team. They confirmed that that was, you know, not uncommon. And so we began to see what we could do to make a response to him and to the other vessels involved.
So you've travelled out to the ship, haven't you?
Yes, we've been out to the vessel a few times, actually. The Yazrak Moya, as a container vessel, is... it's probably the size of 2.5-3 football pitches.
Wow.
It's an enormous vessel. So that was the first thing that struck me, that how could this enormous thing just be left for month after month? I mean, as we drew closer, the condition of the ship. So what was once a beautiful kind of black and copper ship is now really just rusty. And as you draw up closer, you just see more and more the terrible conditions on board, that this vessel is pretty well unseaworthy now. You climb the kind of the 12, 16 feet up, and then you're dragged the final part over the railing by the crew.
Were you the first people they'd seen?
We were the second people they'd seen. They'd had some contact from a water delivery vessel that had come a few weeks before.
And what was their reaction?
What was really wonderful was they were delighted to see us. We later discovered they'd all put on their official uniforms because, yeah, we were actually going to come on board. So we were certainly the first people to come on board. And despite having nothing, you know, the first thing they wanted to do was offer us some water and a cup of coffee.
So I'm on board with one of the other crews. We've just had a look into the water tanks. Unfortunately, you won't be able to see down there, but it's almost entirely empty. At the bottom is just unpumpable water.
Just describe to me the conditions on the boat. I mean, what did you notice as you walked around?
Well, the rust, the dilapidated conditions. I mean, they showed us the bathrooms where they're currently filtering seawater to try and get water to be able to bathe in or to use for the toilets. They use that filtered seawater for some of their cooking. They previously had almost completely run out of water. They told us stories of how they'd run out of diesel, of bunker fuel, as they call it. And so, you know, they were managing with 1 or 2 hours a day with some sort of generator power to charge phones and to be able to do the cooking. And then they showed us what they ate, and they'd been eating dal and rice pretty well every day for months.
How were they physically?
They showed us where, I guess, probably being out there in the salt water and the sea conditions had really brought some nasty lesions onto their skins. And they were the sort of, you know, if you've been living in confined conditions with just 9 other people for that period of time, certainly 1 or 2 of the crew were showing signs of, you know, pretty serious emotional disturbance.
What sort of signs were they showing?
Oh, I mean, you know, the captain was worried of 2 members of crew who are, you know, beginning to say odd things, beginning to sort of suggest they might do things, you know, doing things to themselves, self-harming.
But I keep our crew, all crew keep positive. Think positive, we will get a salary, we will go home one day.
They were one of the vessels where, yeah, there was still a daily routine. And even though this vessel was really unseaworthy, you know, the oiler would still go and oil the parts, the decks would still be cleaned. They would still try and maintain some sense of routine. They needed to have something to keep a sense of purpose, a sense of, you know, having some meaning to what they were doing rather than just waiting.
What toll has this had on Captain Ayapan and his crew's families back home?
I mean, that's probably some of the saddest news, really, that a number of crew members have had parents die. One crew member's had a baby born and hasn't yet, you know, been able to hold that baby. Captain Ayapan himself.
Family facing a lot of financial critical situations. My wife's all jewels in a pledged in bank. And I have a housing loan, interest going every day high. Totally I lost my life.
Yeah, I get regular messages from his daughter, who's only primary school age, saying, you know, Daddy, when are you coming home? I'm making plans for the summer. And, you know, I think it gets harder and harder for him to say, I will be home. I will be home soon. Coming home soon has dragged on for a long time.
Karen, what I don't fully understand is, why can't they just take the ships to shore and go home?
There's a lot of things that's stopping them. The main things are that it's almost impossible for them to leave the ship without cooperation from the owner. It is illegal for a ship to remain unmanned at sea. And because of that, the port authorities will not grant permission for seafarers to come ashore unless they are replaced by another crew or arrangements are made for the ship to be taken over by another owner.
And is there any other way they could escape? I mean, sorry, this probably sounds stupid, but could they dive?
Drop over the side of the vessel? I mean, I guess they could drop over the side of the vessel and swim to shore if they could make it that far. But they've then got all the difficulties of documentation. They wouldn't have a visa for entering the UAE. They would have a visa for being on the ship. One of the other problems in this situation is that, in this situation of abandonment, is that it's in the seafarer's interest in these cases to remain on the ship. The only way that they can get their wages, if a ship owner does not agree to it, the flag estate take action against the ship owner and arrest the vessel and sell it for their wages. But if the ship is without seafarers, the ship deteriorates very fast. There's no maintenance, and the value of the ship goes down.
So essentially, they're trapped there because even if they could get to shore, they wouldn't have paperwork to get out of the UAE and get back to India. And anyway, their only hope of getting their wages is to remain on board. But meanwhile, months and months are passing by. They've still not seen their family. Are there no protections for seafarers like Captain Ayapan when they find themselves in this situation?
There is now a clause after the unions have fought for it in the Maritime Labour Convention, which requires all ships to have insurance so that the insurance can pay for if a sailor, a seafarer is abandoned, the insurance pays for their wages for 4 months. And that was introduced in January 2017. However, the difficulty in Captain Ayapan's case is he is in UAE waters. It's a UAE flagged ship, and the UAE have not signed the Maritime Labour Convention, so he doesn't have those rights.
And are UAE the only country that haven't signed up to the regulations?
Of the 44 ships reported abandoned in 2018, 15 of them involved flag states that had not ratified the Maritime Labour Convention, and that includes Bahrain, the UAE, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Dominica and Tanzania.
What did the ship owner say about this case?
When I spoke to Eliteway Marine Services, they said to me that they had run into financial problems, which is why they couldn't pay the seafarers. But they said that they were trying to resolve those problems and that they hoped they would be able to pay the seafarers soon.
So when you reported this story in April, how much were they owed?
They're owed £270,000 for all of the crew, and Captain Ayapan himself is owed £74,000. That is not including their repatriation costs.
We are all working. We are all working. But why he kept us on board like this? Like a slaves.
Would you describe it as modern day slavery?
To me, and I've seen modern day slavery in other forms, in other parts of the world. These are the worst conditions I've ever seen anybody kept in. I mean, yeah, it was worse than being in a prison, because they couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't, there's so little space to do anything. They had no idea when the next delivery of food was going to come. They were always just waiting and waiting for somebody to respond to their messages.
What's happened to all these abandoned ships now?
Three of the vessels from this company have now been arrested, which means that they can now be sort of taken, seized and sold. Because the vessel has been abandoned, the way the courts seek to deal with it is by arresting the vessel and therefore seizing the vessel as an asset then. So that vessel would then, it would be within the rights of the Federal Transport Authority of the UAE to sell the vessel and to use the proceeds to pay the crews.
So back on the Azraq Moya after a number of weeks.
At the point we're recording sort of this, what's the situation right now for Captain Ayapan and his crew?
So Captain Ayapan has himself and three other seafarers still on his vessel. The other six have accepted lesser terms of somewhere between 40 and 60%. Even today, Captain Ayapan was messaging me saying, "You know, Andy, I'm not going to go for less than 80, 85%. That's what I'm owed." He knows that because his vessel has now been arrested, that he could or should get 100%. But what Captain Ayapan also knows is that the process for actually selling a vessel and then getting the proceeds to the people who are owed can be very lengthy. So every seafarer has a choice to make. At what point will I say, yes, I'll take the cash offered and return? And at what point will I not do that? And I think for Captain Ayapan, I sense if they offered him 80 or 85% of what he's owed, he'd probably say, that's as good as I'm going to get. I need to go back, see my wife, see my daughter, return home.
I've just been looking on Google Maps with our producer, Lizzie, at the coastline where the ship is. And it's pretty strange seeing all these images of sunbathers on the beach when somewhere nearby, maybe almost in sight, there's this abandoned crew. Can they see land from the ship?
So from their vessel, you can just about make out some of the buildings in the distance on Sharjah or in Ajman. I did stand on the beach at a place called Umm Al Quwain, and I knew that Ayapan's vessel was probably 8 or 9 miles directly in front of me. We did have a sort of slightly amusing WhatsApp conversation as I said, I think I can just about make you out, which I couldn't. But I thought it might just give them a bit of encouragement that they could be seen and were being thought about from the land. But you're right, on that bit of beach, the great majority of people were topping up their tans and enjoying a cold Coke and just relaxing, not aware that just a few miles out, there was this misery.
What would you like to see happen for people in this situation?
Well, I think several things. I mean, I think we need every country in the world to sign up to the Maritime Labour Convention, which is the sort of UN-mandated convention for how seafarers are treated. Many of the Gulf states won't sign that, and they won't sign it primarily because it allows for the freedom of association, and they're very fearful, I think, of people gathering together and forming unions and sort of supporting one another across an industry. But I think also we all need to become much more aware of what happens at sea. Much of what we wear, much of what we eat, much of what we use every day has been brought to us via the sea. 90% of everything comes via the sea. And I think if we all become more aware, then we become more aware of those who bring those things, the seafarers who bring those things. And whilst it will be true that the great majority of seafarers are fairly treated and work with reputable companies, we're aware of 20 to 40 other vessels currently in the Arabian Gulf that are, if not already declared as abandoned, will be pretty soon. So this issue is not going away, and I think it requires more international pressure to get countries around the Gulf to do something about it.
That was Reverend Andy Bowerman and The Guardian's Karen McVeigh. Keep up with her reporting on the website. Coming up, how the global super rich are exploiting a tax break in Italy. Now, The Guardian's wealth correspondent Rupert Neate has recently returned from a trip to Italy. While there, he discovered why the world's millionaires are buying property in the country after the government introduced a flat tax of just €100,000, no matter how much money they earn.
Vale, buonasera, signor Guardian.
That's Ariana. She's an estate agent in Florence, and we're here because she showed me around this multi-million pound villa. The villa looks like nothing from the street. It's just a white wall with a door. The guy finally opens it, and you're like, oh.
Oh my God.
Please come.
The main thing it's got is the view from your luxury veranda with your champagne. You can see the sunset behind the Duomo.
Wow.
That's what they all want, apparently. This one, he was refusing to say how much it was for sale for, so I still don't even know. 50 million, 30 million, 40 million. So the owner of this house has put it on the market because there's suddenly a huge extra demand from overseas buyers looking to move to Italy because Italy's introduced a flat tax on the super rich where you'll be guaranteed to only pay €100,000 in tax a year. So he's already had quite a few billionaires look round it. Now the estate agents are really noticing a big uptick in super rich people coming there to look. So I thought I should come and have a look. Bill Thompson is the chairman of Knight Frank Italy, and he was telling me about all these clients that he had coming over.
Okay. What does 30 million get you?
30 million buys you a Medici villa, complete with indoor swimming pool, ballroom, offices for the staff, all the toys.
How many staff would you have?
To run that house successfully, you're going to want to have about 4 or 5.
Wow.
So a lot of these houses are obviously like big, really nice villas, but they also come with an olive grove and a vineyard. And Bill makes the point that something that these rich people want to do is own a vineyard, and then they can be in the vineyard club with all the other people that own a vineyard.
You become part of a kind of wine-growing fraternity that know one another all over the world.
Initially, the super rich, and importantly their tax advisors, thought that maybe this was too good to be true. So there was a sort of slow uptake of it. They were worried that the new populist government might rescind the tax break, but Conti's government has since guaranteed that this tax break is there to stay for the next 15 years.
If you think about the tax regimes around the world, they all put you in relative isolation. Think about Jersey, think about the Cayman Islands. And people seem to say that there's actually a trade-off between, I hate having to be on this little island, but I've got to do it for tax. And suddenly, the Italians have said, have Florence, have Milan, Rome.
I spoke to quite a few local people, and there's lots of concerns already in Florence that rich people have been going to Florence for hundreds of years, but rents there are much higher than they are elsewhere in Italy, and the more and more rich people that come, that will, you know, increase prices of property, and that will trickle down to smaller and smaller properties, and it'll make it even harder for Italians to live in Florence or the other prime locations in Italy. Reports coming out about rising inequality and what can national states do to improve inequality? Well, they could increase taxes on the very rich, but then the very rich can just move. And unless all of the world agrees to close down tax loopholes or have similar levels of taxation, the rich people and their very well-paid advisors will always find a way around it.
That was Rupert Neat. Do read his piece online. My thanks to him and to Reverend Andy Bowerman and Karen McVeigh. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Gary Marshall and Brenna Daldorf. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.